Raising the Bets is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give. You're listening to Raising the Bets. We're a Catholic couple raising five kids outside of Boston. Join us as we share the joys and challenges of marriage, homeschool, and our adventures near and far as we make sense of the world and experience the best parts of our culture. I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Melanie, I know we don't say, like, it's a podcast of pirates and penguins anymore.
Uh-huh.
Probably we stopped doing that because we thought we would do more with that than we did.
Yeah.
And then we realized, like, it sounded kind of weird. Like, if someone just hopped in and said, why is it a podcast of pirates and penguins? Because it was the kids thing. And Anyway, today
I kind of miss it.
Yeah, I do kind of miss it a little bit. But today, September 19th, as we record this, is Talk Like a Pirate Day.
Arr.
What's a pirate's favorite letter of the alphabet?
Arr. Okay. One of my pet peeves.
Yes.
Somehow, whenever it's Talk Like a Pirate Day, there are always more people who say arg than there are who say R. And I want to know where the heck that G came from. Like, because when I was a kid, it was always R.
It's just R. Well, it's because people don't know how to spell anything. And so they write A-R-G-H on Facebook and Twitter. That's why people do that. Don't do that. It's R, not arg.
It's a pet peeve of mine.
They're not dying. They're not like in the, what is that cave in the castle Arg in
Monty Python
and the Holy Grail.
Yeah. Anyway, talk
how
like
do
a
pirates
pirate
know that they're pirates? They think, therefore, they are.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
Why don't pirates shower before walk the plank? Because they'll just wash up on shore later.
That's enough dad jokes. Thank you. You've proved your point.
They will make their reappearances at different points during this podcast.
Oh, no.
At unexpected moments.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I can just imagine you're gonna do this like, all right, that's podcast is over. Slam your hand down and stomp out of the room.
It could happen.
It could happen. It may be worth it. So, as I put my watch on, do not disturb. So today, besides being Talk Like a Pirate Day, is Sunday, and my mom came to visit.
I went to
go pick her up at my brother's house where she lives and brought her home. And we were going to go to Mass all together. And I say we were going to because my mom walks with a walker.
She's elderly and frail.
She's in her 80s. And yeah, she's unsteady on her feet. And she has two metal knees. She's more machine than woman now. So anyway, she has a hard time getting around. And the kids, you know, all came in to say hello to grandma. And I went to go make a cup of tea for grandma and aunt. I wasn't looking, but apparently Anthony came in and was being a 10-year-old boy, was very enthusiastic in giving grandma a hug. And they both went over. I think he was half under her. I think he kind of cushioned her fall, thankfully.
Yeah, we should have, in retrospect, sat her down firmly into a chair first before the kids.
The kids. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
poor grandma.
Yeah. It was scary for a bit. I'm not going to lie. I was a little worried.
Yeah. When elderly people fall, it's not just like a fall. It's like,
it can kill them, literally.
Right. Potential like, breaking bones.
Bones. They go up in the hospital and they never come home again. I mean, it's not to be scary, but scary. Yeah. So, yeah. But she was okay. I mean, she's probably going to be a little bruised, but she didn't hit her head. She didn't break her hip. She seemed fine. She was up and around, you know. She was as mobile as she usually is, which is not very, but she was at least moving about on her own.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So anyway, you two did not make it to Mass.
So we didn't make it to Mass because to get to Mass, we'd have the drop off. There's a walk, then into an elevator, and then a walk across the church to where she
because the elevator is in the very back of the church.
Right. And it just would be, I mean, I suppose we could have sat in the very back. There's the walk to the elevator, too. It's an old church. They've done their best to make it accessible, but it's not all that accessible. So she and I stayed while the rest of you went to Mass, and we watched Catholic TV Mass, you know, the CatholicTV.com, you know, Catholic TV based out of Boston here and with Bishop Reed, which was good. We'll talk about that later. But she and I did that while you guys went, and you met our new pastor.
Yes. Who recognized us as the Bettinellis before I had a chance to introduce myself.
That's good. I was a little worried because I know Father Matt. He and I have had interactions in the past a very pleasant interaction, dinner, I was, and that sort of thing. But I didn't know if you met him before.
I hadn't met him, to my knowledge. And I was preparing, like, not to seem weird, but, like, you know my husband, and so, like,
yeah. we're scripting
in my head, you know, like, how am I going to introduce myself to him? And then he's like, before we even, like, I can get in a word, he's like, and you are the Bettinellis, right? Yes. So our cool. reputation preceded us.
Yes, yes. So it's great. I'm sad to have missed him, because I probably won't see him again for another month while he makes his rounds through the parishes. But it's great to have him at our parish now. So that's going to be really cool. And we're going to have him for dinner. Him and Father Chip.
Yes.
We can have them both over at some point. That'll be awesome. All right. So that was Mom coming to visit and going to Mass. And then the rest of the day, Mom and I watched the Patriots game on my laptop while you guys watched The Bad Batch and Mysterious Benedict Society on the big TV. Which was fine. We enjoyed that. And then I tried to explain podcasting to my mom again. She didn't quite get it. She was talking about Frasier and how he had a radio show and had another job at the same time. I think she was hinting that maybe I should have to do this and a job. and asking me, do you have to get a license from the government to do this? Like I think she's worried I'm like pirate radio.
Oh, yeah. That's you.
No,
pirate,
no,
pirate radio?
Well, it's talking like a pirate day. Maybe it was all the my talking like a pirate that got her, that gave her that impression.
Maybe.
I was talking like Hondo Anaka, actually. No, that's a pirate you should talk like. Star Wars thing. Anyway. yeah. So, but the other things that we did this week, just besides having my mom going to visit and meet the new pastor, unless you've been living under a rock, and if the way the media covered it, you might have missed it. Is the Inspiration4 SpaceX launch. I first heard about this from the Catholics of Oz. They talked about this last month, that this was coming, and I had missed it somehow, that SpaceX was having the launch of a Crew Dragon with four civilians on board called this Inspiration4 mission. And it's four people who are not professional astronauts. One's a billionaire CEO of a company. Surprise. I mean, who else can afford that these days? Okay. All right. But he's not just going up to barely touch space and come back down again. It was 3 days in space, and he was taking people, not his best friends with him, but three regular people. One woman was a scientist and who had previously applied to NASA to be an astronaut and had reached some level, like near finals. She didn't quite get to the final round. She was like a semifinalist, but she's a geoscientist. She's an artist. And she has a pilot's license, private pilot license. He is a pilot. He has flown in acrobatic teams. He's one of those prototypical daredevil CEOs, you know, that you see out there.
Uh-huh.
And then there was a guy who won a contest to go, which that's like me. That guy was like, I kept looking at a guy going, that would be me. And then because he's like a dad. He's just a regular guy. He entered a contest by donating money to St. Jude's Children's Hospital. And then there's this young woman who's 29 years old, who is a childhood cancer survivor through St. Jude's, and then became a physician's assistant at St. Jude's. And so they wanted her to go up. And she's like, are we going to the moon? Like, she's clueless at first about the space and everything. This was not on her radar. And she's the youngest person to go into space, the first person with a prosthetic. She has a prosthesis in her leg. So it was really fascinating. And so they talked about this on the Catholics of Oz podcast. And then I watched the Netflix has this series of limited, you know, series with, I think they've only done two episodes or three. And then there's going to be one more after the mission that they're putting the footage together from the mission. And it was kind of fascinating to see how they got selected, how they came together. They're raising money for St. Jude's. And let me tell you, it's kind of cool that they kept talking about St. Jude. Like, St. Jude's name is said about a million times in the midst of all this. That's kind of a cool thing.
So, and they had to, like, undergo lots of extensive training, right?
Yes. So they were informed of the mission, like the various members, apart from the guy who's bankrolling it, in February of this year.
Okay.
And they've been training ever since. Now, I didn't get a sense of whether, I don't think they've been continuously training, like they had to quit their jobs and go do this.
Uh-huh.
I think they've had periods of coming together, and then the last, say, month or so, a couple months, that was actually intensive, we're going training.
Okay.
This. It was interesting because, they're not professional astronauts, so they didn't act like the reserved, like, you know, I'm very emotionally reserved and very cool under pressure. Mm-hmm. They're like, woohoo! And, you know, really, you know, excited, scared. You know, the Chris Sombrowski is the guy who said it was like me. His wife talking about it was like, I'm very excited for him, but I'm also very scared. And I'm going to be honest, I'm not sure about this. And
that's kind of how I would feel if you were going up into space.
Right. Yeah.
I was sitting on top of a rocket.
I was watching this and looking at her talk and going, this is how Melanie would be. Well, actually, Melanie would hate being interviewed. she would be mad that I made her sit and get interviewed by the TV. But also you would be saying things like, I'm very scared and I'm not, you know, I'm hopeful, I'm trustful, but I'm very scared about this. And I'm going to be honest about that, which is cool. So I watched that, and then this past week on Wednesday, they had the launch. We watched it, the YouTube live, and we watched it during dinner on my phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. And I mean, it's historic.
No, it was fun.
Yeah. It turned out to be fun. And it was kind of awesome to watch that.
Yeah. We don't usually let dinner be co-opted by TV, but there are some exceptions.
Yes. The previous exception was watching the end of the Patriots game last week.
Yeah, that's not one I want to make a regular habit of.
We will not make a regular habit. Well, they do too many of these 4 p.m. games. Right. Anyway, if it's a blowout, one way or the other, we're not going to, we won't do it. So the watching the launch, though, was really cool because I was looking at thinking, I don't think, like, Chris Sombrowski won this contest. I think I remember vaguely this contest being out there, being announced during the Super Bowl. And saying, I'm not entering that because if I won, I couldn't go. Like, there's just no, like, health-wise, family-wise, you know, I there's no way I could sit on top of that rocket. And I was kind of worried, to be honest.
Worried about him?
I was worried about the rocket. I was worried about something going wrong.
Well, I mean, we are the Challenger generation, right?
We've seen Challenger and Columbia come to a bad end.
Right. So we have a sort of a, I don't know, more of a visceral lived experience of like when spaceflight goes wrong. Like I remember how horrifying that was.
Yes. I remember being in school in 1986 and having the Challenger explode because Krista McAuliffe was a teacher in New Hampshire, but she was from Massachusetts. I think like she was originally from a town here in Massachusetts. So there was a huge investment in her personally in this area, like she'd been all interviewed in all the ways and all this other stuff. And so I remember, and in 1986, I wanted to be an astronaut. I was working to become one. I was going to become an aerospace engineering major. I was going to go with the Navy and become a pilot. I mean, this was my path. And then that happened and it had a huge impact on me. And then Columbia in 2003, breaking up over Texas during reentry was a big deal to me, both of those events. So, to see these people going up, it was something. All right. And I was nervous. I didn't want my kids to experience that. I don't want the wonder of space exploration to be tainted. I mean, I want them to be realistic about the dangers, but I didn't want them to be sad, you know?
Right.
So, but thankfully everything went well. My favorite moment was the still shot that someone saved of the four of them in the rocket as it's going up. And Haley is the young woman who's on board, the physician's assistant. And she had like the biggest grin on her face. Like she was ecstatic going in the G's, going into orbit. It was hysterical. Like her, just the sheer joy radiating off her was awesome. So
that's pretty cool.
And then on Saturday, we watched the splashdown, watched them come back through reentry and then get out of the capsule.
That was pretty moving. Like it was. I also felt like I had been holding my breath like from the whole time.
Yeah.
Like not literally, but that sort of like
the release of tension.
Release of tension. Like yeah. Whew, they made it.
Right. Because coming back, like we saw with the Columbia in 2003, coming back is just as dangerous as going up.
Right.
So as soon as we saw that capsule was splashed down in the water, safe, that you could kind of let go. And then again, like watching them come out of the capsule and, you know, being kind of normal people, like thumbs up and kind of dancing a little bit, you know, in excitement, not like I'm cool test pilot astronaut. You know, it's just they're normal people.
Right.
I kept saying that if I were the guy that, you know, who the leader, the mission commander, the billionaire dude, I totally would have said to the first microphone, take me to your leader, and just like would have been totally awesome. That would have been like a moment for the ages.
Uh-huh.
I guess he's not a dad joke kind of guy.
No.
Anyway, so really cool. And then last night, so Saturday night after we watched the splashdown, who was it that
Ben
brought it up? Ben has been using this app on his phone called Sky Guide, which is a, you know, space constellation app. And one of the cool things about it is if you hold it up to the sky and you move it around, it kind of shows the sky behind what the camera looks at.
I have to say, I had always, like, when I was a kid, I was interested in space. And I had one of those, like, you remember the little round thing, the disc thing, and mm-hmm. you, like, turn it and, like,
set the date.
And I could never figure out the constellations from that thing. It confused the heck out of me.
Right.
What I love about Sky Guide is you literally hold up your phone to the sky and it adjusts the sky map so that your phone is pointing at the right
direction. You can
even
have a see-through so it turns the camera on so it's overlaying the constellations over the live image of wherever you're standing. It's really awesome.
It's a great app, but Ben figured out how to turn on the notifications so that it gave him a warning when the ISS was about to go over.
Right. So we got a warning. The International Space Station is going to pass overhead. And I'm thinking, I'm not sure we're ever going to be able to see that. We're in suburbia where we got streetlights. I mean, that's hard to see just even the regular planets and stars. So we go outside and he's like, there it is. I look up and it's like, it's as bright as an airliner. It's the brightest thing in the sky apart from the moon.
Right. Like, I think if Venus were in the sky, the ISS would have been brighter than Venus.
It was certainly brighter
super
than
bright.
Jupiter, which was pretty bright.
Right.
It was wild. And watching, we stood there watching it go slowly across the sky. And then tonight, when I was taking my mom home, you guys went out there again and saw it again.
We saw it again. It wasn't quite as dramatic tonight. It wasn't as high. Like, the elevation wasn't quite as high. It was further closer to the horizon, and it was mostly behind the trees.
Yeah.
But still, I think, you know, and looking at it, I'm like, I could have, like, seen it before and just thought it was a plane going across the sky, because it really looks like it could be a really high, like, plane.
Yes.
I would not have thought that's a satellite.
Right. That's a satellite
with people on it.
Right. That's something orbiting the Earth. No. It was awesome. So a lot of space stuff this week.
It's been space week.
I did manage to be able to say the joke. That's not the moon. That's a space station.
Yeah. <no.
laughs> Oh man, it was awesome. All the opportunities. So, that was our big excitement this week is space stuff. That's, as you know from the episode title. I think we didn't really do much
other than that this week.
Yeah, it was a quiet week. We have busy weeks and quiet weeks. Next week's going to be a busy week. So
yeah,
we'll hear all about that.
We did. The kids did have a scout recruiting event on Saturday, which was pretty quiet. Basically, we just like hung out by the town hall, and like there was one during the time we were there, one family came by that had four little girls who are all super cute. Uh-huh. Their oldest was Lucy's age.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, oh, if you join, then you'll be in Lucy's den. And Lucy, so I trotted Lucy forward and had her like
Introduce herself.
Cute. She was very shy and not wanting to talk at all and kind of mad at me for trying to make her talk. Otherwise, the kids just kind of played Frisbee. And the very nice people who own the pizza shop across the street from where we were came over and brought two pizzas for the scouts to eat, which was really awesome.
Nice.
It was a very nice small town, you know, moment. Yeah, it's been
quiet.
Getting used to school stuff. Bella's getting used to her chemistry class and trying to get everybody else on track with school.
Yeah. Hey, Melanie.
What?
Where can you find a pirate who's lost his wooden legs?
I don't want to
know. Right where you left them.
Oh, yeah. I suppose he can't get very far without the wooden leg. He could scoot.
Yeah, he could scoot a little bit. Arr. Anyway, so let's talk about what we've been eating.
Mm-hmm. It's been soup week and apple dessert week.
Apple dessert, three apple desserts, three soups. So let's talk about the apple desserts and your foibles, your difficulties.
I'm usually a pretty good baker, and this week was like, you know, we all make mistakes.
So first was the apple pie.
The apple pie was really good.
Came out really good.
I am not a pastry person, and I cheat, and I use...
You buy the store.
The previously made frozen crusts. I like to get the ones, though, not the ones that are in the, like, aluminum pie plate, but the ones that are rolled up, and you have to defrost them and unroll them. And then put them in your own pie plate. I feel like those have a bit better texture.
Yes. And the aluminum pie plates just aren't good support anyway.
Nah. So, but we just get like the Stop and Shop brand. I think Pillsbury has some, but
yeah,
Stop and Shop brand is fine. And I actually did
it
cut one
came
of,
out of the same bakery.
Right. I cut one of them up and made a lattice crust, which looked really pretty.
Yes.
We used some of the apples we picked last week and, it came out really good. I put a little bit of cloves in, and I put a lot more lemon zest than the recipe calls for, and I think are both like magic.
Yes, I think that came out really well. So that was good. Then there was the apple bread.
Yes, it was supposed to be a Dutch apple bread. I skipped the crumble coffee cake topping because it was too fiddly, and it was tired, and it was a weeknight. I mean, baking on weeknights is already just...
Yeah, I suppose.
Time-consuming.
Yeah.
But the real mistake I made was I forgot to put in the milk. I think I was mentally debating, should I use milk or should I substitute the milk for apple cider? And would that work? And then I ended up doing neither. It was a really thick batter, but there was enough apples in it that it did not.
It wasn't all dried out.
It wasn't dried out.
In fact, it was a little underdone. It was a little moist.
I didn't cook it quite long enough. And so it was a little bit underdone in the middle. It was almost like a pudding.
Well, that might have also been because the milk proteins might have contributed to the setting of the dough too.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Because I think also if I did it again, I might actually have divided the dough into two smaller loaf pans instead of one larger loaf pan, because that can also affect how quickly
getting the heat to the middle. Yeah.
Right. So it tasted good. Nobody complained.
And there was a glaze on it too, wasn't there?
There was the glaze. Once again, I do not have a great luck with glazes. Once again, it seemed to mostly end up on the plate.
It tasted good.
The glaze, well, it was an apple cider glaze where you're supposed to cook the cider, boil the cider down into like about half, you know, reduced by half. I don't think I reduced it quite enough because I was trying to multitask.
This is also why you forgot the milk, and this is why you're multitasking and forgetting things.
Which again, why I don't usually bake on weeknights because there's not as much time. I generally tend to bake on weekends. But it came out good. Everybody ate it. It except Lucy. She has decided she does not like apple desserts at all. I do not know why. Course. I don't know if it's the cinnamon or just the apples or who knows. She's just not a fan. I did add lots of pecans to it, and I just love pecans. But
are we in the bread or the cake?
The bread.
The bread, okay. There was pecans in the bread, too. Yeah.
I put pecans. Pecans and apples. Man. I mean, I grew up with pecan trees in my backyard, so they're just... They have to be there.
Okay. And then what was the third one?
I made an apple cake. It was a bundt cake. Yeah.
What'd you forget?
I grabbed the wrong thing of flour because we had just bought some self-rising flour for biscuits and some new containers. And I, in my distraction, did not read the label on the container. And I had left the regular all-purpose flour on the chair in the kitchen, and then it had got like something put on top of it. So it was like, didn't see it. It was hidden.
Yeah.
Self-rising flour, but I also added salt and baking powder, like a tablespoon of baking powder to the self-rising flour,
in case you don't know, self-rising flour already has the baking soda and the salt in it.
Yes.
So you basically doubled the amount of leavening. So leavening is what makes it rise.
Yeah.
And rise it did. Rise up.
So I got it into the bundt pan and then realized, fortunately, before it went in the oven. Also, it was really full. Like, it was like less than half an inch from the top of my bundt pan. There was no way that was going to
You
fly.
Saved yourself a really big hassle
so
cleaning
I grabbed,
out that oven.
So I grabbed a loaf pan. I greased it up. I spooned the half the cake batter into the loaf pan. Not quite half, but I spooned it into the loaf pan, and then I put both of them in the oven, and it rose right up to the edge
right
of both
the
of
edge.
Them, but it did not overflow.
Guardian Angel watching on that one. Guardian Angel's like, oh, how many times am I going to catch these
right?
things for you?
Bailing me out. The flavor was good. I mean, it was a little on the salty side.
Yeah.
But the crumb wasn't bad. The texture wasn't bad.
It was moist. It was really moist.
It was very moist.
It was kind of fall apart moist.
Those apples really add a lot of moisture.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if it would have been as much falling apart texture if it was the regular flour and not.
It might have been a little bit more sturdy, a little bit more firm.
Yeah.
I have a lot of apples left.
We're going to have a lot more apples and a lot more chances to screw them up.
So tune in next week for more apple adventures.
At some point, we're going to have to just applesauce them because they're going to start going bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
there's a container of applesauce I made this week that the kids have not touched.
Well,
even.
Because we've been eating all the apple desserts.
I know.
That's the thing of this time of year. It's a plethora of apple dishes.
It's just apples.
Didn't we do like it? We once did a honey mustard apple chicken dish. Do you remember that?
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, it was interesting. I think we were looking for ways to use up apples.
Yeah. I may end up like putting some applesauce in the freezer.
That's not a bad idea. Anyway, so three apple desserts. We also had three soups. The last 3 days we've had soup for dinners.
You know,
I'm not sure how that worked out, but
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, one of them was I had seen leeks in
the farmer's market.
The market and thought, ooh, potato leek soup. I love potato leek soup. And then we
the leeks that sat in the fridge for a while.
The leeks sat in the fridge because we didn't have cream. And then I ended up using the leeks for in my tortilla soup, which we made because we realized that we had way too many broken tortilla bits that just needed to be used up.
So that broken nachos.
Tortillas.
Tortilla chips. That's right. Not tortilla bits, but tortilla chips.
Tortilla chip bits.
Yeah. So not like flour tortillas in the fridge, but like chips, bags of chips. In fact, I was curious. I weighed it out.
It was like 2 pounds.
It was like 2 pounds of...
I weighed it too.
Yeah, because what happens is we get, you know, we open a bag of chips, the kids eat them all up, and then there's this layer at the bottom of just the broken bits that are too small to dip or to make into nachos. And so they roll it up, stick it back in the little basket where the chips live, and then we open a new bag. And there was like, I collected them all, 6, 7 bags. I think it was 6 bags.
And that's on top of the bags I had previously consolidated, which was a good solid pound of chip crumbs.
Right. So basically each bag when bought new is a pound. So 6 bags produced a pound of chip bits that were left over. That's a lot of wastage. I mean, a lot of people just throw those away. And there's only so much tortilla soup you can make. We got to find some other thing to do with these leftover chips because I am not throwing them away. Anyway, so that was the impetus for tortilla soup. But you made it a little different. It wasn't chicken tortilla soup.
No, I had some pulled pork in the freezer, so I was deciding that we needed to kind of clear out some of the backlog in the freezer.
We're working through some of the freezer stuff. Yeah.
And so I thought, pulled pork, tortilla soup, it should be good. And it was. It was a good call.
The texture ain't the greatest. Like, the stringiness is a little...
Well, but tortilla soup is supposed to use leftover chicken, which also has a similar...
I guess so. It felt a little stringier than, but it was still tasty as all get out.
Right.
It was really good. And the great thing about tortilla soup is it's one of those little bowls of things, soups, that there were meals that kids like to build their things. So you add in, you know, tortillas, chips, and you add in avocados. And maybe some corn.
Yeah, we put out bowls of like frozen corn and
cheese. Whatever else.
Scallions,
yeah. If you have sour cream, you can add sour cream even. I don't know if I would add sour cream to mine.
Mm, nah.
Limes. you know, lime juice.
Oh, yeah. Lime slices. Yep. Those are popular.
So, yeah. So that's a good thing to do. And then we've talked about tortilla soup before. And then the next soup we made was potato leek soup. So we did actually end up making the potato
leek soup. Right, because we got more leeks at the market.
Okay, and so leeks, you can go potatoes, carrots.
Yeah, I know classic potato leek soup does not have carrots, but...
It has a little color to it. Otherwise, it's all like one color.
Right, and I think it adds a little bit of like a pop in the taste, yeah, too.
Yeah, some flavor that it adds.
And then with some bacon and some scallions, like at the very end, you add the scallions, so they have a nice little bit of a crunch to them, which is good. A lot of heavy cream and a lot of butter.
Yeah. And it's not white, a low-cal
right.
soup.
Some white wine, I think, and homemade chicken stock.
Yes. That was really good. And of course, all these things are better the next day because they get a chance to sit and meld in the fridge and you warm them back up. And then tonight for dinner, we made Vietnamese meatball in watercress soup, which I've talked about before. I'd seen watercress at the supermarket last week. And I said, oh, let's get some of that, make some.
Right. So it was like we didn't really plan for a week of soups, but we sort of kept thinking of like ingredients that were favorite.
It's soup season, you know, fall is the beginning of soup season. So
still not really cool enough for soup, but I guess we're just sort of jumping the gun.
Yeah. And this Vietnamese meatball and watercress soup is so good. Everyone likes it.
It's one of those dishes where you think, I don't really want that. And then you start eating it and you can't stop eating it.
It's addictive as all get out. Like, it's like crack
your
soup.
Mom had like three bowls.
Yeah.
It was, she loved it.
She did. It's full of umami. I mean, it's
good. And even the kids who are like, I don't really like this, ate like half a bowl.
I mean, Lucy ate a couple bowls. Sophie did. Bella had one, which I think she was trying to be disciplined because she knows her tendency is to want to keep eating until she's uncomfortably full. And so she's like, I'm going to eat the one, which is a sign of maturity and growing up. So that was, that was really good.
It was tasty.
Yeah. All right. Moving on.
Anthony kept saying, it's like a very wet meatball salad.
Yes, it's a very wet meatball and watercress salad, which is very funny. Anyway, what does the pirate say when his leg gets stuck in the freezer? Shiver me timbers!
You mean his wooden leg?
Yeah. His wooden leg. Well, if you're talking about a pirate's leg, you can assume safely it's the wooden one.
I suppose.
Yes. What do you call a pirate with both eyes and all his limbs? A rookie.
I've heard that one before.
Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about what we've been reading and watching.
I finished Years of Rice and Salt. Woohoo!
Yay! We don't have to talk about it again. No, just kidding.
It was good. I liked it. And then to make up for the really massive novel, I read three very short ones.
Yes. They're all connected.
All connected in a series. So I think earlier this year, I had read The Breadwinner by Deborah Ellis.
You talked about that.
I talked about that.
Yeah.
It's a story about the girl in Afghanistan whose father is thrown in prison by the Taliban, and she dresses up as a boy to get a job and like feed her family.
Right.
Because the women cannot go out because of the Taliban.
Timely reading, by the way.
So, yeah. I mean, given the recent events in Afghanistan, that novel has kept coming back to me, and I was fishing around for something to read, and all my on hold books at the library were still on hold. So I just bought the rest of the series,
the Breadwinner sequels
on Kindle. And so the second book is called Parvana's Journey. It begins. So in the end of The Breadwinner, she and her mom and siblings had all escaped to Iran. And but her dad was still in prison. And so she journeys with her father to go find the rest of the family.
Okay.
Parvana's journey begins with her burying her father.
Oh, wow.
He got sick in one of the refugee camps and died. And so now here is 13-year-old girl dressed as a boy traveling across Afghanistan while the war is going on, looking for her mom and sisters and brother. This was not an easy read. This was really hard. She finds a baby in a bombed out house whose mother is dead, and she just can't leave him. So she picks him up and she carries him, like puts him on her back and carries him wrapped in her scarf. Then she finds a young boy. We're not really sure how old he is, who only has one leg. And so she ends up taking him along. And then they find a little girl, 8-year-old girl, who's living with her grandmother. Her mom has gone off to try to find food or find her father or something.
But has never come back.
Has never come back. And the grandmother is elderly and has basically just taken to lying on her bed and staring at the wall. While this little 8-year-old girl is somehow managing to stay alive and keep her grandmother alive by, they live next to a minefield and animals keep wandering into the minefield and getting blown up. And the little girl runs into the minefield and grabs the carcasses and drags them back and eats them. And then a peddler was killed and she like managed to run into the minefield
and get his stuff.
So she's convinced that she's like magically safe from the mines. She's 8. So right. There's a lot of magical thinking going on. They eventually end up, the 4 of these children wind up in a refugee camp, and they do eventually find Parvana's family.
Okay, that's the one book?
That was the one book. Oh. It was really, really just a very hard book. Like, this was a kid's book, and I was thinking, I'm not sure how many kids could really handle this, because it was...
Right, that's intense.
It was very intense. It was not a very long book either. It was just a lot of really intense stuff. And I mean, it's told kind of gently. Like, it's not too gruesome, but there's a lot of death.
Yeah.
And so then the 3rd book in the series, Mud City, actually goes to Pakistan, where Parvana's best friend Shazia has gone. And she's in a refugee camp in Pakistan having run away from her family, who she wanted to marry her off to an older woman. I mean, older man. Yeah. So she's actually there under the protection of their former gym teacher, who is this very large, overbearing, bossy woman.
Uh-huh.
And Shazia just can't stand her. And so she decides to run off and in boy disguise and make her own money so that she can, her dream is to get to France. That was another really difficult book. She spends most of the novel as a street child, like trying to make money in various ways in the streets of Peshawar.
Okay.
I mean, this is a really rough series. It's really about like the people of Afghanistan being in a country which has been at constant war for decades.
Right. For 50 years, probably.
Yeah. And it's rough because they remember these girls who are 13. Do you remember at times when their families lived in really nice houses with televisions and they went to school and their mothers worked, and now they are like reduced to living in these tiny little rooms, and they just like how much they've lost. It's really almost depressing, but at the same time, there are glimmers of hope.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 3rd novel, I mean, the 4th book in the series, the 3rd one that I read, was called I Am Parvana. And it begins with our heroine having been arrested by American military. And she spends the entire novel in prison.
Okay.
While you have to figure out how she got from the refugee camp where you last saw her to a school which has been bombed. And why she was there and what's going on. And the American military says that there were arms hidden on the grounds of the school. And they found a woman who had been tortured, who was buried. And they're trying to figure out, they think that she's working with the Taliban and that she's a terrorist.
Hmm.
Again, 16-year-old girl.
Right.
It was really interesting. Like, the narrative structure was really good because she refuses to talk. She does not say a single word, despite intensive interrogation. And the backstory basically starts in the past, and you go through flashbacks, and you get just like little bits and pieces, and you're trying to figure out, okay, how did she get to the point where they're like, what's going on here? It was really good. It was really well written. It reminded me a bit of Codename Verity, which again had a, there was a World War II novel that had a young woman who was in prison and you get little bits of her backstory until you figure out how she got there. Again, lots of death, lots of war and destruction, but they do found a school for girls during this like brief time of peace when the Americans peacekeepers are there. But it's an uphill battle.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the local people don't want a school for girls in their community.
Right.
And there's lots of threats and violence. And yet there's also this like little bits of like they're trying to cling to hope to make something beautiful. It's not an easy series to read, but it's a really good one. I highly recommend it because especially now, if you kind of want to understand what's going on in Afghanistan, I think stories like this are a really good way of...
Especially if you have a child, especially older teen, perhaps, who is been aware of what's going on in the news and maybe affected by it, this might be a way for them to kind of deal with it.
Right. And to humanize it. Like, this is, you know, these are people's lives. This is not just a news story.
If you have a if you have a child who's sort of, I've seen kids who kind of end up dehumanizing these pictures on TV, like, oh, we should, what are we over there for? Like, what do we care what happens to those people? This will humanize the people.
Right. I have to say that especially the last book, My Name is Parvana, does not always paint the Americans.
Well, I am the most, Parvana.
I am Parvana.
Yeah. The Americans don't come off as great.
No. They're not horrible, but they're also, she does not assume that they're on her side or that they are friendly to her. There is an antagonistic relationship. And I think that it kind of, I felt sort of torn at times. Like, I'm like, just trust them, tell them, talk to them. They'll be on your side. But I kept thinking, well, will they? Will they necessarily believe her? Will they be on her side if she tells them her story? You want to think that they would be. But realistically, they're human beings and they're in a war zone and who knows, you know? So that was an interesting aspect to it, too. Then the other book I wanted to briefly mention was a book that I finished reading to the kids. It was our read aloud for the last few weeks called Where the Mountain Meets the Moon by Grace Lynn. And it's a really fun fairy tale sort of novel based on Chinese fairy tales. Grace Lynn is a Chinese American, and she sort of talks about how when she was a kid, her mom wanted to help her connect with her Chinese heritage and had left books of Chinese folk tales around, which she thought were kind of boring and dull, although she read them, and they just didn't come to life until she went to China. And then suddenly these old stories that she had like back in the back of her mind, like took on this life. It was a really lovely story. And the kids were like, kept saying, you can't stop now. You have to read the next chapter. You have to read the next chapter.
Good. So
highly recommend that one too.
Awesome. So I watched a movie called The Wrath of Man, but it's directed by Guy Ritchie, starring Jason Statham. So you can imagine there's a lot of bad language and violence, but it was interesting. It had a non-linear narrative structure.
Okay, I'm a sucker for non-linear narrative structures, as you know.
Yeah, you start at one point, you go forward, then it jumps back before that, goes forward, then it jumps again, and then it jumps back to the end. It was very interesting, and it was unexpected. Like, so Jason Statham's character, you know from early on that it's about, how do I phrase it? There's a series of armored car robberies.
Okay.
That are, it starts with one that ends with the guards and a kid being shot. And you see Jason Statham getting shot too. And the kid and the guards die. And Statham is shot. And he obviously has a connection with the kid. He's the kid's father. And then we go to him, becoming a guard at the company, and we get the idea that he's going undercover to get justice to catch whoever did it.
Uh-huh.
But it's a lot more complicated than that, and as you go on, it starts unpeeling these layers. it was interesting. I mean, it's a very violent movie, obviously.
Right.
And I picked out who the inside man was.
Of course. Of course you did.
Yeah. And it's never the obvious one. Just put it that way. I just look for who's the one who was the least obvious one. That guy. He's it. But it was still good. It was interesting. And it was unexpected. I mean, at least with this Guy Ritchie movie, I could understand what everyone was saying. Like Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. I needed the captions so I could understand what the people were saying.
I thought that was such a fun movie, though.
Well, it was fun. And especially because of the actors in that. Some of the actors in that. Was it that the one with Brad Pitt doing the accent?
I thought that was the second one. Not Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels, but the sequel.
Oh, maybe. But Brad Pitt was in one of those.
He was in one, yeah.
But they, like, I mean, Guy Ritchie did like a King Arthur, which was horrible.
I didn't see that one.
Yeah, no. But these sorts of movies, they actually work pretty well. And so this was pretty good, I have to say. It was a pretty good movie. It wasn't great cinema, but it was pretty good. Then we watched, you and I watched, the pilot for a show that I don't even know if it's still on anymore, but it has six seasons, called Longmire.
Right. I remember my mom watching that like quite a while back. And
I've heard lots of really good things about it.
You know, I'd heard lots of good things about it, but every time I kind of like saw the title fly past on, is it Netflix?
Yeah.
I was just like, I don't know if I really am in the mood for like, whatever this is, cowboy show, I don't know. Yeah. But you put it on and I was like, okay, fine, I'll watch it.
Right.
I'm not expecting a lot, but, you know, whatever.
So it's about a sheriff in a county in Wyoming who is older, old school. He's a widower. His wife died within the past year, and he's been, you know, suffering in the grief. And is just emerging from the grief.
Right. You get the sense that he's maybe been neglecting his job a little bit.
Right.
And most of his team are sort of covering for him.
Right.
Because they know that, you know, he's been through a lot. He will eventually be back with us. And meanwhile, we can just like take up the slack.
And so his team includes like the young square jawed. The guy who thinks he's a hotshot, who wants his job, in fact, is running for sheriff against him.
Right. But he's not quite as...
But he's not all that he thinks he is.
Right.
That comes up, is even more apparent in the second episode, by the way.
Did you watch the second episode?
I did. I didn't know you wanted to keep watching.
Oh, yeah. I would totally have watched that with you.
Well, we can keep watching together.
Okay.
And then Katie Sackhoff, who is Starbuck from Battlestar Galactica, but also Bo-Katan from Mandalorian.
I totally did not recognize her until I was like looking for like who is the.
Oh, you didn't. Oh, funny.
I did not immediately recognize her.
Yeah.
But she does not look like.
Well, very interesting. I really like Katie Sackhoff as the actress. She has a YouTube video where she talks about what it takes to get in shape for different roles.
Right.
And the different appearances that actresses, especially actresses who do action, have to go through.
Right. Because in this role, she looks very petite.
She looks petite and softer, like she's more curvy, as opposed to Starbuck. She was very angular and, yeah.
Right. And Bo-Katan is very, like...
Angular. I mean, she's in the armor, so it's harder to see her physicality, but...
But she comes across as very, like, I don't know, the way they cut her hair, the Bo-Katan haircut, she looks very square-jawed.
Yeah.
And kind of, like, her face severe. Just had a very different shape, almost, to it. It's amazing what, like... armor, makeup,
and physique,
hair,
workout,
and
she talks about that in that video, which is really interesting. So and then Lou Diamond Phillips is in it as the Native American friend of the sheriff. There's conflict with the tribal police on the Indian reservation. Then you get Wyoming as the backdrop, which is awesome.
And it's, you know, mystery.
And it's a police procedural, essentially.
Right.
We solve the murder.
I like police procedurals, especially police procedurals that are kind of off the beaten track a little bit.
This
unusual.
Is way off the beaten
this
track.
This is definitely, yeah.
You know, I watched, I can't remember, was it Yellowstone, I think, was a series. It's a Kevin Costner series. It's more soap opera-y. I watched maybe half a season of that. I could get back into it, I suppose. But there's not really any good guys in that show. Everyone's sort of scheming. This one, you sympathize with Longmire. You kind of identify with him. He's a classic cowboy. He's like John Wayne. You know,
he is a sympathetic character.
Yes. And the second episode deals with the Mennonites and Rumspringa. Yeah. So, you know, they're like the Amish.
Uh-huh.
And so that was, it was interesting and good. And that one I didn't call it, although I should have.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I'm surprised I didn't, call the who the bad guy was, but
you missed it.
I won't miss it next time. So anyway, Longmire is good. Then I finished my novel that I've been reading, To Wake the Giant, a novel of Pearl Harbor by Jeff Shara. This year, 2021, is the 80th anniversary of Pearl Harbor.
Was that deliberate then?
No, actually it wasn't. But I've read some of the Jeff Shara that was set in the Revolutionary War, and I like them. So I was thinking of reading some more, and this I saw this as one of it. He's doing a new series based on the war in the Pacific. So I picked this one up. He has a Midway one that just came out or is coming out right now. And Jimmy Akin is doing an episode on Pearl Harbor in December.
Oh, okay.
So cool. I figured, I've read and seen movies, and it's not my first exposure to Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But what Shara does is very interesting. He creates novelizations of real events that are as close to the real event as possible, including even using the actual words that people said, whether they were written or spoken, then recorded as dialogue.
So like,
he stays true to history as he possibly can, but in a
narrative form. They might not have originally been dialogue, but he kind of works in the particular place, but he works it in to make it kind of fit.
Right. This is the sort of thing he would say. This is as close, this, we know he would say something like this because he wrote it down.
Right.
That sort of thing. Or he said it in a speech, or someone said, this is what he said. So we get very close. And so the main characters are Yamamoto, the Japanese admiral who was the architect of the battle. Cordell Hull, who was the Secretary of State, Roosevelt's Secretary of State, which is an interesting choice to go with him. But mostly because he was the one who was doing most of the negotiations with the Japanese ambassador.
Interesting.
And then a sailor who was on the, what was his name? Brig, who was on the Arizona, who was apparently, I didn't realize, he was a real guy too. And the stuff that's recorded is what really happened to him. He was a pharmacist mate on board. And there's a lot of tension because you know what's coming.
Right.
You know, they're not going to avoid it. It's going to happen. It's really, but even knowing what's going to happen is really well done. Like, just because you know how the result is, there's the sense of what actually happened that comes across. And you really feel a sense of, this is what people were thinking about in these times. This is how people felt about the Japanese. This is how people felt about war and the possibilities and what it was like to be a kid from a podunk town in Florida who joins the Navy and sent to Hawaii, in which we would think, wow, that's I want to be stationed in Hawaii. And he was like, nah, because his experience was, I'm on board the ship and then we go on Liberty and we drink until we get sick and get thrown back on the ship. And the locals don't like us because we're carousing the sailors. So there's no point in, you know what I mean?
Right. It's a very different, from going on vacation to glamorous Hawaii.
And in 1941, he was a kid from a poor family. He'd never seen a movie before and gets to watch a movie that's being shown on the fantail of the ship on a big screen. And wow, seeing a movie is the greatest thing ever. And like getting a real sense of the people, of what it was like from the point of view of that time. That's right. What I like about Shara's books is he really gives you a sense of the point of view of someone in that situation, not as a 21st century person. You know, a lot of times books and movies and TV shows, they drop 21st century people into these historical places.
Right.
I mean, they're a person set in that time, but they act and talk as
and think
like a 21st century person.
Right.
Whereas this, he tries to make them as much a product of their time as possible, which is what made the Revolutionary War books good, because it gave you a real sense of that. So that was a good book. I'm looking forward to reading the next one, which is about Midway, because we're going to get the Japanese back. After that. and that's it. So far. So, by the way, why'd the pirate join Gold's Gym? to improve his booty.
I'm shaking my head.
Rolling your eyes. How'd the pirate get the Jolly Roger so cheap? He got it on sale. Get it on sale. So no. Let's talk about...
Just no.
Let's move on to talk about today's gospel and mass readings. So the gospel is from Mark 9, and this was the two-part gospel. It's very interesting that these two pieces come together, because we start with Jesus telling the disciples, as they're walking from Galilee on a journey from Galilee, he tells them that the Son of Man is going to be handed over to men, and they'll kill him, and 3 days after his death, the Son of Man will rise. And they were, but I like this, they didn't understand what he was saying and were afraid to ask.
Right?
I don't know what he's saying. Should we ask him? I'm not going to ask him. You ask him. I'm not going to ask him. Which, you know, you could guess that probably was what he would expect.
Right. They're poor students who don't quite get what's going on and don't want to let the teacher know that they don't understand. Right. And so they're like muttering amongst themselves, completely missing the point.
Right. And then because you know, once they're done telling each other, they don't understand what he said. So which one of us is the most important? Well, obviously, I'm the most important. No. I'm most important.
Right.
And then when they get there, Jesus says, what were you guys arguing about? Knowing very well. Classic parent tactic, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You never ask a question you don't already know the answer to.
Right.
Jesus is on the ball here. And they remain silent. Right.
As most students do when they're caught not like on task.
Yes.
Right. It's a great human moment where they've been caught,
right,
and they know they've been caught, and they're not going to give themselves away anymore.
Who's the greatest? I'm the greatest, says Muhammad Ali. Then he sat down.
Father Matt made a really good point about this. In the ancient world, sitting down indicates that he is being a teacher.
Yes.
Like he is taking the seat of authority, because in the ancient world, the teacher sits and the students stand.
Just like the ruler sits. So when Pontius Pilate judges Jesus, he sits on the judgment seat.
Right. So this is Jesus both being the official teacher, the rabbi, but also maybe kind of the judge. He's judging their behavior.
Well, and he's also showing he's the authority. He's the Son of Man. So I love this. He doesn't say, look, you should be more humble. He doesn't just tell them to be more humble.
Well, also, there's a great contrast, too, between, like, what is he talking about? He is teaching them about his death, his resurrection, eternal life. And what are they arguing about?
Who's the greatest? I'm the greatest. No, you're the greatest.
But also, like, sort of temporal matters. Like, right. It's egotistical. It's self-centered. It's all about me first.
Yeah. I'm going to suffer and die in a most horrible way.
Jesus
and then rise
the
from the dead to save all of humanity and redeem the universe.
Right. Jesus is the suffering, is presenting himself to them, revealing himself to them as the suffering servant. As
he's the Messiah who's going to save them all.
As the one who is going to lay down his life for his sheep. And they're like sitting there saying, so when he's king, who's going to be the most important? Well, clearly it's going to be me. I mean, I'm going to sit at his right hand.
So what he's saying, I think, is that he's going to be the Messiah. So that means I get to be the guy who sits next to him. No. I get to sit next to him.
Right?
Missing the point, boys. Missing the point. So, and then he takes the child, places it in their midst. Which is an interesting construction. I don't know what the Greek there is, but maybe the Greek is indistinct, and so they don't know whether to say him
or
her.
You know, it's interesting if you read, like, older English works, like, before, like, the 60s. The
reference to a child, yeah.
It was a reference to a child. Even when they know the gender, it's often like it.
Yeah.
It's something that just rings really wrong on modern ears, but it's actually a really common construction
in older English.
And not that much older English.
Right, obviously, because this English is only about 80 years old. So
right.
So he placed the child in their midst, putting his arms around the child. He said to him, and which a very intimate movement.
Right. I love the fact that he's not just standing the child in front of them uncomfortably, awkwardly. Let's all stare at this little kid.
Using the child as an object.
Instead, he's embracing the child and holding him like it's tender. It's caring and maybe making the child feel safe with all of these grown men standing around staring at him.
And also, contrasted with that we refer to children as it. Part of that might be that adults didn't see children, especially not their own children, as all that valuable. Jesus is making a point about the value of children.
Right. Like Father Matt said, you know, this is the era of like children should be seen and not heard. Children are not usually privy to adult moments. And this is a, you know, a rabbi teaching his students. This is a very adult moment. Mm-hmm. Not this is not like kiddie school. This is up here level. Right.
This is grad school.
And yet here's this child. What's this right. child doing here? He's not up here talking theology and politics and, right. you know.
And he's making the point. This child, you're all worrying about who's the greatest. Whoever receives a child who you all would probably discount as valuable.
Right.
Is receiving me. A child is important as not just me, but as the one who sent me.
Right. Whoever receives me receives God the Father. So the child is as important as God the Father.
Right.
If however you treat this child is how you're treating God the Father.
Yeah, pretty heady stuff, which it's an awesome moment. I can't wait to see it in The Chosen. I really love, because that's one of the things I love about the series, The Chosen.
I still haven't got around to seeing
which
that.
Which we haven't seen yet, is because it shows these human Jesus moments.
But the other thing that, you know, is that children say what they say what they think.
Right.
They're purely in the moment. When you watch a child at play, they're like, they are where they are. They're not thinking about the future. They're not thinking about like themselves. There's the child is not egotistical in the same way that they're being egotistical, like
right.
thinking about power and ambition. This is just a little child who's not concerned about
the child's stuff. Concerns are small.
Right.
And very personal, local.
Yeah.
Immediate.
And so this is Jesus saying, be small, be right. little. Like John the Baptist says, he must increase, I must decrease.
Like St. Therese of Lisieux, like St. Francis, be small.
Be little. Be little. Poor. Yeah. And Father Matt ended with a really great moment, like talking about how our egotism, our selfishness sets up roadblocks to the grace that God wants to give us.
Mm-hmm.
And that when we empty ourselves of that ambition, that desire to be important, that desire to be seen, and we focus on the one thing necessary, like with that childlike attention, like that laser sharp focus of the child at play, that's what we need. That's the kind of focus we need to have on Christ to be disciples. That one thing necessary.
Interesting. So the one thing I wanted to mention from the Catholic TV Mass with Bishop Reed is he was talking about the first half of the reading about the Son of Man being handed over and its connection to the Gospels of recent weeks. And he made an interesting point. He said, our suffering can be a cross. We can unite our suffering to the cross.
Right.
And it becomes our cross that we carry. But our suffering doesn't become a cross for us until we embrace it like Jesus embraced his cross and offer it up.
Interesting. Like, so it's a potential cross, but it's not an actual right. cross until we actually.
Right. Suffering is just suffering.
Right.
Not all suffering is redemptive.
Right. So it's a cross when we take it up as a cross.
Right. It becomes a redemptive, because the cross is a redemptive instrument. And so.
But it's
suffering
that,
can become redemptive when we embrace it and offer it up.
Right. It's that moment of not what I want, but what you want that Jesus makes in the garden.
Right.
Like that's the moment of taking up his cross.
Into your hands I commend my spirit. You know, that's right. the completion of that.
I mean, this is the thing, though, that I think we were talking about this last week, too. Like that in the moment when you are experiencing the suffering. How to do that, like how to express that in your life, you know.
I don't think it has to be a formulaic expression. I think it could
right.
be just an emotional release of to you, just blah.
Right. Like it's more about an act of the will, like
yeah.
casting our hearts, our minds to God and saying, I can't bear this, but let it somehow be whatever you your will is for me.
Right.
Like it's a matter of turning our hearts, our minds to God, which doesn't have to be like formal prayer or lengthy. It can be a moment of grace. Like it doesn't have to be this lengthy production, because oftentimes when you're in the middle of suffering, it can't be.
Yes.
It's still really kind of a mystery to me.
Well, yeah, it is a mystery. the way of the cross is a, you know, the dark night of the soul and all of that is a master class, you know, to really delve into that is a master class of the great spiritual masters.
Right.
So we'll continue to plot our way through. We should wrap there. I do want to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create Raising the Bets, including Randy L., Afton R., John M., Jerry M., and Peter D. Their generous donations at sqpn.com/give make it possible for us to continue Raising the Bets and all the shows at StarQuest. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. So that's it from us. We'd love to get your feedback, to hear from you what you think of anything we've talked about. You can let us know by commenting at sqpn.com/bets. That's BETTS. Or the SQPN Facebook page, facebook.com/StarQuestMedia. Or send an email to bets@sqpn.com. And links from our discussion are in our show notes at sqpn.com. We greatly appreciate it when you write a review of the show at Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps to have reviews there. And when you share the podcast with your friends to help us grow our community and reach more listeners. Until next time, I'm Dom Bettinelli.
And I'm Melanie Bettinelli.
Thank you for listening to Raising the Bets on StarQuest.